I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Democrats and conservative Republicans say the White House at best misled, at worst lied to them, to win support for Medicare legislation. The bill was passed last November with supporters touting budget estimates of less than $400 billion. New reports say some backers knew all along the number was closer to $551 billion and that a top Medicare actuary was told to cover up that estimate or lose his job. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is with the New York Times. Cheryl, this week, Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson launched an investigation into this alleged cover-up. What prompted that?
Well, what prompted that launch was the revelation that Rick Foster, the chief actuary of the Medicare program, said that he felt threatened, that he would lose his job if he revealed higher cost estimates than those that were used to pass the bill. This leaked out through emails and ultimately in an interview in which Mr. Foster said pointedly that his boss, Tom Scully, then the Medicare administrator, threatened to fire him if he revealed these higher numbers.
How unusual is that? I mean, some people might assume that people are told to keep things quiet all the time.
Well, Democrats say it's highly unusual. They say that they have had access to the actuary for years and that they could simply ask him for his nonpartisan cost estimates and they would get those estimates. This time around, though, Democrats say they asked Mr. Foster for his estimates and he said, I can't give them to you. I don't have permission, and I could be fired.
In addition to that story, the House Ethics Committee announced yesterday that it started an investigation into charges that GOP leaders tried to bribe a lawmaker to back the bill. This is Michigan Republican Rep. Nick Smith. He voted no anyway on the bill, but he said that he was told that his son's political career would be affected by his vote.
That's right. Nick Smith is retiring from Congress, and on November 22nd, in the wee hours of the morning, when House Republican leaders were trying to gather up all the votes they could for the bill, Mr. Smith says that some lawmakers and groups told him that his son, who is running for Congress, would receive substantial financial support if Mr. Smith changed his vote on the bill from a no to a yes. And he's been saying this repeatedly, and the Ethics Committee started an informal inquiry last month and yesterday announced that it was stepping up its investigation into a more formal investigation. Mm.
You mentioned that Democrats are protesting this, but conservative Republicans went through some pretty strong arm twisting on the night of the vote in November as well.
That's right. Conservative Republicans are not happy about this. They are upset over the cost of the bill. They were upset when it was to cost $400 billion. So any suggestion that Medicare prescription drug benefits are going to be even more expensive is upsetting to them because they're very worried about the budget deficit, and they've been pressing the Bush administration to bring down the deficit.
Well, in addition to the two stories we discussed, the General Accounting Office is investigating tapes made by the government, designed to look like news reports with phony reporters being aired by smaller TV stations across the country as news pieces when, in fact, they're promotions for the Medicare bill. Coupled with these other stories, how damaging is all of this Medicare news to the administration?
Well, it's certainly not good news for the administration. Tom Daschle, the Senate Democratic leader, has said he sees a growing scandal, and certainly Democrats will make hay of this in a political year. Republicans, on the other hand, will defend the bill. They will say that the administration has the right to promote it and to try to do what it can through video news releases or other materials to ease the confusion among consumers. And they say Democrats are simply exploiting these matters for political gain.
And back to the cost estimates, isn't it true that these are usually just estimates, just that, and as the Wall Street Journal said, just polite fictions? Is the bigger problem here maybe the trust between President Bush and his party?
I think that is a big question. I know some Republicans were unhappy with these recent stories and immediately called the leadership in the House of Representatives to say, what's going on here? One lawmaker quoted in our article today said that if someone was pressured to withhold information, then that is wrong and inappropriate.
Cheryl, thank you.
Thank you.
Cheryl Stolberg is a reporter for the New York Times.
President Bush is at Fort Campbell in Kentucky today. It's the eve of the first anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq. No military base in the country has lost more soldiers in Iraq than Fort Campbell. 60 of the 567 troops killed in Iraq over the past year were based there. Attacks yesterday in Iraq claimed the lives of three more American soldiers. Today, it was Iraqi civilians, including journalists, who were killed. We turn now to reporter John Danishevsky, who's in Baghdad for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome, John.
Hello.
John, you know, there's tremendous attention here to the first anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq. How about there?
Yes, I think everybody's aware that the anniversary will be Saturday here. And there's a lot of assessing going on. But ordinary Iraqis, are they better off or are they worse a year after the war and with the downfall of Saddam? And also the guerrillas seem to be taking over the anniversary as well, and they appear to be stepping up their activities in these days leading up to it.
There was a poll earlier this week that indicated some 57% or so of Iraqis felt they were better off without Saddam Hussein. Is that your sense of it from the street as you move around?
Yes, I think it's not very controversial that they're better off without Saddam. You'll find pockets of people who like Saddam and say they're better off. But generally, among especially Shias and Kurds, there's no doubt in the question, and the Sunnis are divided.
John, what's the sense today among Iraqis about yesterday's suicide car bomb in the Karada district?
I think people felt very badly to have a big explosion like that happening right in the center of the city. It was almost symbolic. It happened just near the square where the infamous statue of Saddam was toppled on April 9th. And it was a reminder, an unwelcome reminder that in many ways the war is not over for Iraqis.
Yesterday, some were blaming the coalition. Has that died down with the immediate emotion around this terrible bomb?
Yes, I don't think anyone seriously thinks that the coalition planted these bombs. People say such things in the heat of the moment, especially when there are Western journalists around. But I think what they do feel is that the coalition is in charge of the country, and so it bears responsibility for not creating the security environment that stops these attacks from taking place.
More attacks on civilians today, and that seems to be the trend, as civilians being hit more than soldiers. What do Iraqis say about that?
Well, they don't like it, of course. It causes everyone to sort of check their routes to avoid places that they think might be targets. It causes parents to worry when their children don't come home on time, and it causes people to stay home rather than go out and risk maybe being a victim of an attack. And there's a feeling also that these attacks, especially when they're hurting people like aid workers or members of the coalition who are trying to help the country, it sets the country back.
Would you say that the average Iraqi is more or less pro-American at this point?
I would say the average Iraqi wants America to leave the country in a reasonable period of time and to have Iraqi sovereignty and Iraqi government restored. But I think the average Iraqi also feels that if the troops were to go home right now, that, you know, there would be a high level of danger of civil war and more violence. So they don't want it to be a precipitous withdrawal. But as long as the trend moves towards free elections, which I think is the thing that most Iraqis want, and their own government, I think they'll be happy.
Election scheduled for 2005. John Danishevsky is a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He joined us from Baghdad. John, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Japan, Italy, Britain, and Australia may be next on the terrorists' list. A letter signed by the Abu al-Masri Brigade, which claims responsibility for last week's Madrid bombings, names those four countries as possible targets and warns that new attacks are planned. This comes as European interior ministers prepare for emergency security talks tomorrow in Brussels. To talk about Europe's response to terrorism, we're joined from London by Dana Allen, a senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Welcome.
Hello.
To the Abu al-Masri letter first, it was sent to the London Al-Quds Arabic newspaper. It lists the four countries I mentioned that backed the Iraq war. Is that letter seen as credible?
the strategic impulse is credible, let me put it that way. It certainly seems to be the pattern that al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-affiliated groups are going to strategically target countries that were allies of the United States during the Iraq War. Having said that, I don't think any Western countries are immune, and they certainly don't consider themselves immune.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because it was Germany that called for this week's meeting of EU ministers after the Madrid bombing. And so it seems like you're saying that countries like Germany and France that oppose the war are also at risk.
Certainly they're at risk. I mean, the September 11th attacks happened before the war, and France, just to take one example, has long been a target of Islamist terrorists. What I was trying to suggest is that there is probably going to be an attempt to play on this sense of division in the Atlantic Alliance, but that doesn't mean that anyone is safe.
Mm. What do you think about the idea that these countries in Europe are trying to somehow pull together some sort of defense? How difficult is this going to be?
Well, of course, one has to start with the observation that defending against this kind of terrorism is inherently difficult. There are extra difficulties in the European case because Europe is not one country. They have a whole set of different intelligence organizations, different law enforcement organizations, to a certain extent, different laws. But they've been working together, working hard to coordinate, especially since September 11th. They've made some progress. I think that in another sense, European anti-terrorism capabilities, and particularly intelligence, is formidable.
As the EU ministers meet together tomorrow and pull together, how is last week's bombing in Madrid going to affect U.S.-European relations?
Well, there is a danger, of course, that the Spanish election results and the announcement by the prime minister-designate that Spain will withdraw its troops from Iraq are going to deepen the transatlantic divide. There's no question about that. I think it's probably counterproductive for American politicians and commentators to be suggesting that Spain is appeasing terrorism. After all, it opposed the war in Iraq, and this is the first election that simply reflects what was always the position of the people. But having said that, it might not be a bad thing for Spain, for in a sense the illusion of a new Europe versus an old Europe, to be shattered. The United States is going to have to deal with a Europe that is actually fairly united on many of these issues, was united in opposition to the war in Iraq, at least on the popular level. And so I guess the bottom line is that Americans are going to have to take Europe as it is.
That word appeasement is being thrown around. Spain is being accused by many in the U.S. of appeasing the terrorists. How is that word resonating in Europe, where it's particularly loaded?
It's particularly loaded and it's particularly ill-advised. It's not a word or it's not a lecture that a lot of countries want to hear from the United States right now.
Dana, thank you.
Thank you.
Dana Allen, Senior Fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A year ago tomorrow, the war in Iraq began. 3 weeks later, Saddam Hussein fell and the nation building began. Ever since, there's been heated debate about whether the war was a good idea. The Wall Street Journal yesterday wrote in its lead editorial, "The war in Iraq and Afghanistan is about taking the battle to the terrorists so that we have fewer attacks on our airlines and railways at home." So as a result of the war, are we safer at home or not? I spoke earlier to Richard Pearl, author of An End to Evil. He's a strong supporter of the war. And to Joseph Nye, who's a war critic and author of Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics. Joseph Nye, are we safer at home in the United States because of the war in Iraq?
I don't think we're safer today. It's also worth noticing that you can't judge something like a war until more time has passed.
Mm-hmm.
We're successful in Iraq. We produce a stable and democratic Iraq. We may someday be safer. In the short run of a year, we're better off getting rid of Saddam Hussein. That's on the plus side of the balance sheet. But frankly, it's increased al-Qaeda's ability to recruit, according to intelligence agencies. And it also has squandered America's soft power, our ability to attract the moderates in the Islamic world beyond Iraq.
Before we turn to Richard Pearl, explain that soft power.
Soft power is your ability to get what you want by attracting people to your agenda rather than coercing them or paying them. And indeed, it was an important part of how we won the Cold War. And it's an important part of how we win the war on terrorism, which is to attract the moderates so that the extremists can't recruit them.
So the jury's still out on whether we're safer at home, you're saying, Mr. Nye. We'll know in time. Richard Perle, your thoughts?
Well, I disagree with the idea that we could have made ourselves safer by failing to take military action. We had a decade of soft power. The 1990s was nothing but soft power. And that was the decade in which al-Qaeda was essentially established and took shape and grew into what it became. The rise of al-Qaeda, the rise of radical Islamist fundamentalism coincides precisely with a period in which America wasn't using its military power, in which we did hope that soft power and international agreements and international institutions would make us safer, and it failed miserably.
Richard Perle, has the war in Iraq been a distraction from the war against al-Qaeda?
No, it's part of the war against al-Qaeda and against other terrorist organizations, which collaborate in a variety of ways. There is now ample documentation of the relationships between Saddam Hussein's intelligence organization and a variety of terrorist organizations, including al-Qaeda, elements of which were trained in Iraq and trained specifically with respect to the worst weapons.
Joseph Nye, ample evidence of ties between Saddam Hussein's Iraq and al-Qaeda terrorists and other Islamic terrorist groups?
Well, according to President Bush, not. According to George Tenet, not. You do have some connections between al-Qaeda and Saddam, but I don't think anybody has been able to deduce very clear evidence between September 11th and al-Qaeda. And in the meantime, we diverted attention away from Afghanistan. Now, go back to the 90s for a moment. It's not a question just soft power alone. It's a combination of hard power and soft power. You needed hard power to get rid of the Taliban government, which was providing a refuge to al-Qaeda. But unless you have soft power in addition to hard power, you're not going to be able to recruit the moderates, and you're not going to be able to prevent al-Qaeda from recruiting them.
Joseph Nye, I want to ask you, what points do you then concede to supporters of the war in Iraq, if any? You've mentioned it's a good thing that Saddam Hussein is gone. And what about people who support the war is it that you just don't get?
Well, I think if one is fair-minded about this, one realizes that it's a balance sheet, as I suggested earlier. I think getting rid of Saddam was a good thing. But I think the people on the other side ought to also admit what the intelligence agencies are saying. The way we did it, we actually lost a lot of our ability to attract others, and that increased al-Qaeda's ability to recruit, not just in Iraq, but in places like Indonesia.
And our soldiers are dying primarily over there, and our taxpayers are paying for it primarily. Richard Perle, your thoughts on the same question. What points do you concede to critics of the war, if any, and what about critics of the war do you just not get?
Well, I just don't get the bottom line. I think Joe is right. It is a balance sheet. It was not cost-free to go into Iraq. It was certainly true that we did it without the support of the French and the Russians, which meant we couldn't get the support of the Security Council and the United Nations. That doesn't trouble me, but it does trouble a lot of others. Where I think I take issue most with Joe's view is the idea that the moderates would have been cheering on our side if we hadn't done this. I don't know who he's referring to, if he's referring to moderate governments. The populations among many of those moderate governments are very hostile to the United States, and they were hostile to the United States in part because they don't like their own governments, and we've been colluding with those governments. We've now broken the pattern of supporting every dictatorship in the Middle East, and it's going to take time to build support in a constituency in the region. But we're up against fanatics who want to remake the world in their image. And if moderates are not rising to that challenge in the region, that's a problem, but it's not one that we're in a position to control.
I think, to go to Richard's point about moderates, take Indonesia, which is the largest Islamic country in the world. In the year 2000, public opinion polls showed that three-quarters of Indonesians were pro-American. After the Iraq War, that had declined to 15%, 1-5. That's what I mean by loss of moderates.
Well, I really don't believe, Joe, that people who are attempting to recruit suicide bombers are doing so or are significantly assisted in doing so because of the United States. They have their own agenda. If we didn't exist, they'd go after the next obstacle to the realization of their ambition, which is an Islamic universe. That's right. What we're up against, and the sooner we recognize that, the sooner we can develop strategies to deal with it.
I want to thank you both. Maybe we'll adjourn this again in a year to see where Iraq's at then. Joseph Nye is dean of the Kennedy School of Government. Mr. Nye, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And Richard Pearl is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Pearl, thanks so much.
We'll do it in a year. Take care.
For an extended version of the conversation with Richard Pearl and Joseph Nye, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
As a solution to creating jobs in the country's so far largely jobless recovery, Democratic Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts believes there should be a government jobs program. He outlined his plan earlier this week on Here and Now. Frank's plan includes higher taxes on individual income and corporate profits. He's also called for universal health insurance, so employers who want to hire aren't scared off by medical coverage. Frank's also critical of President Bush's tax policy.
We have had tax policies under the Bush administration that make it worse, that remove all taxes from capital and increase taxes in a real sense, in many ways, on working people.
Well, today, a different view on taxes and creating jobs from Congressman Jim DeMint, a Republican from South Carolina. Welcome, Congressman.
Thanks for having me.
Congressman Frank says American workers essentially need a new deal. Your thoughts?
Well, I appreciate Congressman Franks because he laid out, I think, what a lot of Democrats are not willing to say. And basically, he believes in a government-managed economy and a lot more government involvement in the corporate sector. But let me give a little different perspective. If you listen to what Congressman Franks talks about, it is making it more expensive to do business in this country by adding to corporate taxes and other costs of having employees. Certainly, we do have a challenge in this country. As productivity increases, we can produce more with fewer workers. But the fact that is not often mentioned is most industries now have a shortage of skilled workers, and most are projecting long-term shortages of skilled workers, including manufacturers. Here's what I think we need to do, and I think this is what the president has done, which has made our economy turn around and begun to create jobs again. We must focus on American competitiveness. If you look at what we're doing to business in America, it's almost like we're putting a sign on our beaches that says, go do business somewhere else. We've got the second highest corporate tax rate in the world, second only to Japan, and their economy has been in stagnation for the last 10 years. Countries like Ireland that have caught on to this and reduced their corporate tax rate to below 15% are attracting new businesses. We're not able to get an energy policy through the Senate at this point, and our natural gas prices are the highest in the industrialized world right now. And manufacturers use a lot of natural gas. And you look at the cost of health insurance, which Congressman Franks mentioned, double-digit increases, and we dump that cost onto business. So what we're doing is making it more and more expensive to do business in this country. And at the same time, we've created a lot of disincentives to hire American workers. You talk to our businesses in this country, they do everything they can to avoid hiring a permanent employee because the risk of lawsuits, the cost of benefits, the paid leave, the health insurance, the pensions.
Yeah, but Congressman, corporate profits are up. Shouldn't some of that benefit flow to the 8 million plus Americans who are out of work?
Well, it is beginning to flow, but it begins with profitability, and jobs are coming back in this country. But one of the challenges we have is they're coming back in different places where different skills are required. No longer can people without a good education go to work in a mill and do minimum wage work. What we have to focus on is not only making it less expensive to do business here, but we have to realign our education system so that our workforce is prepared to take these new jobs.
All sounds good, but what do you do right now for those 8 million plus who are out of work? Only 21,000 jobs created in February. Most economists say we need to produce at least 200,000 jobs a month to make up for the jobs lost in the last 3 years.
Jobs are a problem. Anytime someone's out of work, we've got a challenge. But let me give you one example of what we need to do. We've got a technical college in South Carolina that's got what they call a quick jobs program. They're taking people from textile mills that have been laid off and over the last year have retrained 4,000 workers in a 90-day plan that gives them skills that they can get a job. These kind of things are working, and what we need to do is focus on getting our workforce trained to take the jobs that are there while we encourage corporations to be more profitable and hire more people. But we can't encourage them to hire more people by adding to the tax rate, which is already the second highest in the world, as Congressman Franks has suggested. Unfortunately, in our country, we've settled into the paradigm that in public schools, we're preparing children for more education, not the skills that they need. That is one of the things that's holding us back as a nation, is despite doubling what we're spending on education at the federal level over the last 10 years, we continue to lose ground to other industrialized nations.
Opponents of President Bush say his solution to everything is cut taxes.
Well, if you see what happened when he did cut taxes, our economy did begin to turn around and jobs have begun to come back.
But they haven't begun to come back nearly as much as they need to.
No, you're right. And we need to continue to encourage the growth of our industries. We need to expand exports around the world. And, you know, the big debate is on core issues like trade. Are we going to put a wall around our country and try to stop trade? Or do what the manufacturers are saying they need to do. We need to knock down trade barriers all over the world so that we can expand our production here and use our productivity to create jobs rather than our productivity creating overcapacity that means we lay off people. So there's a difference in philosophy here. One is to put more cost on corporations like Barney Franks has suggested. The other is to unleash our corporations, unleash our workforce development and training, and outcompete the whole world, which I believe we can.
In a jobs crisis, given the high productivity of the American worker, why shouldn't those corporations and the people making the money at the top spread some of that around on the bottom for people trying to raise families to do good works in the city?
Our unemployment rate is actually lower than the average of the 1990s, 1980s, 1970s. Those who are looking for a dark lining in the silver cloud of our economy are misrepresenting the facts. Certainly, corporations should be incentivized to share the profits, but expanding and reinvesting that money into the private sector, and that's one of the arguments here that, as Congressman Franks is saying, we need to invest more in government rather than in corporations, does not understand the multiplier effect of private sector investment. I worked for years in economic development in South Carolina. We understand that if a dollar is spent in the private sector, that it generally multiplies itself at least 2.5 times. If the government takes that dollar, the multiplier is usually less than one. Companies can locate anywhere in the world now, and if we think we can get more tax revenue and help jobs by making it more expensive to do business in America, we just don't understand the global economy right now. Are we going to try to government manage our economy, or are we going to make it the best place in the world to do business here in America? That's where we're going to get the best jobs in the world.
Republican Congressman Jim DeMint of South Carolina. He joined us from Washington and is currently running for the Senate. Congressman, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Still to come, we speak with a psychologist about his mother's painful decision to raise a family and forego a career as a concert pianist.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our interview earlier this week with Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank on the need for government to raise taxes to create jobs got a great deal of response from our listeners. Christine Myers of Phoenix writes, I was glad to hear Congressman Frank's comments regarding how the increases in employee productivity we've seen in recent years haven't translated into more time from the average American worker to pursue other interests. For years, I've been hoping that our standard work week would be reduced as we become more productive. Rather, what has happened is that it often takes two wage earners to support a family, as our real earnings have diminished over the last 40 years.
But Charlie Brenner of Lexington, Massachusetts, took issue with Congressman Frank, writing, he claimed that the economic benefits of high productivity are flowing to capitalists at the expense of workers. This is 20th century thinking. Today, the majority of workers are capitalists themselves through their 401ks, union pension funds, option plans, and mutual fund investments. Class warfare doesn't make sense when labor and capital are the same people.
Anna Carter, who listens to Here and Now on WEVO in New Hampshire, wrote after our segment on outsourcing with Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Barry Bosworth of the Brookings Institution. Mr. Bosworth said that U.S. economy has created 20 million new jobs in the last 3 years. Anna writes, you failed to challenge him about the kind of jobs that have been created. It's the well-paying manufacturing and the high-paying tech jobs that have been lost. You have to do better than Walmart jobs or McDonald's jobs to replace those jobs.
Michael Chen took exception to the point made that outsourcing forces the U.S. to come up with new technologies, which in turn replace lost jobs. He writes, high-paying, intellectually intensive jobs are moving overseas, and that includes many research and development activities which have long been the backbone of U.S. economic dominance and vitality. Even with unrealistic improvement in workforce education, we can't possibly expect our workforce to upgrade to all R&D-level positions.
And finally, Jonathan Kirk from Providence, Rhode Island, had this to say about our interview with members of the group Tangle Eye. They remixed the field recordings of Alan Lomax, an archivist of American roots music during the 40s and 50s, and they used their own high-tech sound. Well, Jonathan did not like that. He writes, the one thing that Alan Lomax would probably not want to have happen to his beautiful and unique field recordings is adding a techno beat. While listening to some of the samples and remixes of Tangle Eye, it made me sad to think that the only way we can bring these beautiful works of art to the public is by bastardizing them with added acoustical frosting. In my eyes, that is like placing neon beer signs on Chartres Cathedral.
Well, Jonathan, here's a sample of a pristine Alan Lomax recording, Long Meter Hymn, recorded at the Rose Hill Baptist Church in Greenville, Mississippi, off the CD, Blues in the Mississippi Night.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The music of acclaimed pianist Gita Gudova playing Rachmaninoff's Paganini Variations in 1940 with the New York Philharmonic, fulfilling all the promise she'd shown as a child prodigy when critics raved after her town hall debut at the age of 19. So what happened? Why did Gita Gudova stop playing, become depressed, angry, and an often punishing mother? Tom Cottle is Gita's son and a clinical psychologist. He's written a loving, complex memoir of a brilliant musician who gave it all up for motherhood and, ironically, made her family often pay a price. The book is called When the Music Stopped, Discovering My Mother, and author Tom Cottle joins us in the studio. Hello.
Hello, Robin.
Good to see you.
My pleasure.
Every family may have regrets and a photo album, but your family photo album is extraordinary. Pictures of Mom with Rachmaninoff. And there she is with Vladimir Horowitz, Stravinsky, Yasha Heifetz. Your mother led an extraordinary life early on.
She did. I mean, it's unbelievable. Played with orchestras when she was seven and was an international star. 2021, she had it made.
And there's a clue there. You found she left home at an early age, and it wasn't always a good experience for her.
Right. She first left Chicago at about 13, and therein a mistake, I don't know. But here you have her father, and he felt she had great talent and would not be fulfilled in Chicago, so he sends her to New York. Now, it's a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. You could say, well, don't be a sexist. Perpetuate your daughter's talent. On the other hand, I think he scared her, and I'm not sure that the experiences in New York were great. She was frightened. She was frightened living there.
Yeah, but any concerns she might have had were overridden by the fact that she just had this extraordinary acclaim. Let's listen to a little bit of an early recording. You're not quite sure when this was recorded, but it's Chopin. And what are we hearing in here?
I think what we're hearing is this extraordinary technique that she had, a technique that she always said must be subservient to the composer. She always said, don't think of the interpreter. Don't think of the performer. I'm doing nothing but bringing these dots and lines to you. I should be invisible. And she was on the concert stage, called by many critics aloof. But she said it was because you must not focus on me. You must focus on this music.
She marries, she has children. You write of an extraordinary early childhood when your vantage point of your mother's playing was sometimes from underneath the piano.
Yeah, it's a fabulous place to listen to music.
And the guests that would come through the house. Just describe, you know, the occasional guest at a dinner party.
Mystery guest arrives. I'm not to tell anybody who it is. Bada boom, bada bing, in walks Paul Robeson. Nathan Milstein, the violinist, is painting the murals around my electric trains. Horowitz is a regular visit. Maestro Toscanini is a regular. The first visitor to our home in Chicago, when my parents bought a house, was somebody named Rachmaninoff.
And then... The music stopped.
The music stopped.
Was it as simple as a woman saying, I can't do both, I'm going to be a mother?
You know, if I knew that, I'd have the answer for you. I wish I did. She writes, she tells a columnist early on, there is no way that a woman can't do both. And then she stopped. So why did she stop? I personally think she stopped. The superficial reason was, I think this piano playing caused her some anxiety. I think the major reason that she stopped is that men in her life were imposing too much pressure. And there I must indict my father. In reading his love letters, which are terribly admiring, he's laying pressure on her. When are you coming back? When is this ordeal going to be over? This poor woman is a loser no matter what she does. If she plays, she loses. If she doesn't play, she loses. She's in a no-win situation in which a man would almost never find himself.
You write, she claimed to have stopped playing because of the birth of her children. It was a noble and courageous decision, but it was not a successful one, and we all knew it. She was only genuinely happy when music surrounded her. She denied this on exactly 87 million occasions, but it was true. How does one admit to oneself that one's art may be more important than anyone in one's life, especially one's children?
The problem is she lived too soon. If she were of your generation or my daughter's generation, look at all these people that are performing. They're traveling and they're performing.
But don't you think there are a lot of women still struggling with that decision?
Absolutely. I'll tell you something else, Robin. I think the book is a little bit more universal than I once thought. There was no way that she could win. But here was the problem was the culture was saying, well, what do you mean you're not married? What do you mean you don't have children? You're 28, 29. What are you, 30 years old? You don't have children? Well, what are you, a lesbian? What they couldn't make sense when you read the reviews of what to call a woman pianist, a giantess of the keyboard, somebody wrote. I mean, it's perfectly moronic, but we understand it.
And obviously there are women who do give up careers and goals and are perfectly happy in doing that. But the key to your mother's story is she was not happy. She was not...
She was depressed. She was not pleasant to be
around.
You can't amputate your fundamental talent and go through life as if it's no longer missing. It's as subtle as having all your front teeth knocked out. This was the central piece of her life.
And how could it not be to be that good? I can only wonder how that must feel, to be in the middle of music like that. I can't imagine giving it up.
You could see when she played, and she played all the time. She was playing in the house. She was playing at parties, other people's parties, our parties. And everybody would say, you've got to come back. You've got to record that. You've got to keep playing. And she didn't, and you could just see as the guests were leaving, Robin, and I write this, you could see the depression returning.
So the truth is she didn't do you, her son, any favors.
She didn't do anybody any favors, right. Particularly herself. As a child, I'm thinking only of myself, as hopefully a mature man. My heart breaks for her now.
Yeah. Well, there was a point towards the end of her life, all the children are grown, and she was going to do it. She was going to fulfill a promise to her friend Rachmaninoff.
Yeah, she called him Sergei Vasilievich. We called him Maestro, that she would play his first piano concerto, which she called Rock One, because she was pretty hip. And she said, I'm going to play Rock One. And she was, I got to tell you, she was playing great. And she'd tell me on the phone, not bad for an old broad.
How old was she?
80. She announces her 80th birthday party. I'm coming back. She was going to play Rock One, Chicago Symphony, with James Levine of our own Boston Symphony Orchestra. 1985, July, bada-boom, bada-bing. She dies 3 months before the concert.
Unbelievable.
The last person she talked to was Shure Tchaikovsky. Shure Tchaikovsky is a wonderful pianist, and they used to record, in those days, piano rolls. And she told him, I found out in a letter that he had written to somebody named Stephen, that Gita said to me, I'm not going to make it. Play it for me, Shure. I don't think I'm going to make it. And he said, I can't.
How heartbreaking again.
It is.
Did at least in those last few months, knowing that she was coming back, was there anything, any closure there for you, for your sister, for others, that she knew she was going to try to play again?
It was advancing towards what we know as closure. I think that she was willing to do it confirmed my suspicions all along. That I told her all those years, you'd be happier playing. I'd be happier playing. Of course, I said it not as a therapist. I said it as an angry adolescent, which was, get out of here. Make us all happy. Go away and die, I'm probably told her 1,000 times. But I don't think I really have the closure. It's kind of, I just would have liked it. Because when I eulogized her, I read the review of that concert, the concert that was never held. So I guess that was my desire for the closure.
What did you say?
I know one thing that I said is, you must consider her a great pianist, not a great woman pianist.
Performing it perhaps in some celestial realm.
Well, I say that, I say at the end that it's the concert only the angels heard and that they loved her. She had taught me early on about something called a touche. And a touche is where a performer comes on the stage, the orchestra rises, and the horns blare. I mean, that's a great thing. And I'd heard it several times. When you're a 5 or 6 year old kid going to the concert, that's all you want to hear. To hell with the Mendelssohn, just play the touche. So I said at the end in the eulogy, and not only that, the angels love her, but the orchestra stood and played her a touche.
Tom Cottle, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
Your story. Tom Cottle is a clinical psychologist as well as professor of education and the son of pianist Gita Gradova. His book is called When the Music Stopped, Discovering My Mother.
And this note, earlier we featured an interview with Republican Congressman Jim DeMint of South Carolina rebutting Democratic Representative Barney Frank's plan for creating jobs. To hear both interviews back-to-back, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.